Welcome to episode 95 of the Omnigamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including your kids' restaurant placemat. I am Daniel Winter.
And I am Mark Yuasa. Hello.
Hello, Mark. Welcome to a little soft reboot of the podcast here. We're going to be trying something a little different today.
It's the dawn of a new epoch in this galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
More on that to come.
Yes. So as we discussed last episode, we've had some scheduling difficulties, especially as we start leaning more on tabletop games. And we do both live in the same city, but only get to meet up together once a month or so. We each have our own groups. Those groups have their own tastes, obviously. Scheduling continues to be tricky as an adult. So yeah, we just want to add a bit more flexibility, a new format that adds a little bit more structure to the podcast, a little more consistency, but also some more flexibility. So best of both worlds there. Rather than alternating between features and playlists, we're going to just have one consistent format now, right?
Yeah, and the structure of is a bit different, and we're talking at length about this, but it's really simple.
Yeah.
We're just going to be talking about a couple of games a little bit less intensively than we did in our future episodes.
Yeah.
So it's going to be kind of a hybrid.
Yeah. We really like getting into the weeds and discussing a game in detail. Sometimes a game doesn't have an hour to talk about it. Like this will let us cover a wider variety of games. Well, as is our oeuvre here and having a balanced diet of games, we are splitting this new format into three dishes. So starting off with the appetizer, just to whet our appetite a little bit, we're each going to be bringing in one item. That could be a news item, it could be a game we've been demoing, or just something we've been playing a little bit on the side, some tangential game-related ephemera that we want to talk about for a few minutes. Then we'll be rolling into the main course, where we'll each be bringing in one game that we'll talk about in detail. And hey, sometimes that will both be the same game, and we'll just, as I said, we'll really get into it. Sometimes we'll have a guest, and they can bring their own game, or they can talk about a project they're working on. Sometimes we'll both do video games, sometimes we'll both do board games. So again, flexible format here, it'll allow us to shift our focus as our schedules change as well.
Yeah, and to cap it all off, we're going to have just a light dessert course, which is just going to be a off-topic subject that's on our mind, but it won't be long. So if you stuck with us till the end, then you'll hear a little capper about what else we're into.
Omnigaming isn't just about appreciating all games. It's about acknowledging that games are inspired by a wide variety of other influences and sources as well.
Yeah, you got to feed your soul somehow.
Yep.
So I think we should dig in.
How about that? Yeah. So yeah, our first appetizer. What did you bring today, Mark?
Yeah, I know that I want to dig right into the meat of it all, so to speak. So I didn't bring much to the table this appetizer course. I'm just going to mention, as is my current obsession with handheld systems, I wanted to announce a couple of teasers that were released recently. The two latest devices that people are going to be talking about on the internet, not necessarily here, comes from one company, Ioneo, who produces some kind of higher end, I guess, higher end, lower end portables, as opposed to, you know, middle to high end, like your Lenovo's and your Asus and your Steam Deck. So Ioneo produces slick portable devices. And the latest one that they're teased is called the Classic. And it's sort of a return to form. It's basically a Game Boy Micro format, if you recall that one. It's the very hyper-portable kind of candy bar style.
Oh, yeah.
Cute. Which played GBA games. And I never owned one, which is kind of a regret. It just has such a nice 1980s like retro flair to it, especially in that gold and maroon Nintendo Famicom color palette. So this Ioneo Classic is going to model that sort of like retro futuristic Japanese portable device aesthetic, kind of like the old Walkman devices. I'm kind of excited about that just from an aesthetic perspective. And then the other new device that they teased was called the Retroid Pocket Flip 2.
Oh.
So this time it's going to be a clamshell model, but unlike the compact SP that you and I both own, it's going to be sort of a wider, like 2DS, 3DS type idea with one widescreen at the top, controls in the body. Bit of flexibility.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't know a lot of details about these because they haven't officially announced a lot of them. Just some teaser screenshots. To be honest, I'm not really tempted to get either of these. it's just what the community seems to be talking right now. So I thought I'd bring it to everyone's attention.
Yeah, I've been doing a little bit of research into those retro devices myself, and some interesting discussion on how there isn't really much of a middle ground with these, because the low-end cheap devices have gotten so good that you don't really need to spend a lot of money unless you really want one of those sort of designer boutique ones that just have a design that you really like. Otherwise, you may as well just grab a Steam Deck or even a Switch Lite. It's pretty cheap now, I guess.
Yeah, it's true. There's kind of a device for every hand size and orientation. It's mostly going to be like, do you like vertical handhelds? Do you like horizontal handhelds? Or in the case of clamshells, do you like those? And you kind of slot yourself into one of those channels and you go with it. Or if you're like me and you have an obsession, then you buy yourself four new handheld devices.
One for every weather. One. So as you hinted there, my SP has come in now. So this is the Enbinic SP. I haven't had much time to noodle with it yet, but it does feel nice and solid. Nice form factor, feels good. I'm just looking forward to exploring that. Maybe you can give me some tips on how to optimize it.
Yeah, happy to do it. All right, how about yourself? What is appetizing you?
Yeah, so I've been continuing to expand my solo TTRPG kit. I've been expanding my collection of like pens and notebooks and testing out what feels best for that. I've been hitting up all of the cheap Asian dollar stores to like sample all the pens that they have there. Found one I quite like that I'll be using as a sort of a default. But the other thing I've been testing out in interest of the RPGs that sort of let you noodle with new skills and new artifacts of play, I've been playing, let's find this here, Amending from Xing Yin Core. So this is basically a map-making game, but you sew a path onto a map, like with needle and thread, essentially. You can get a PDF version, print off a map, and basically draw your path on this map, and then you can annotate it with little notes and sketches, if you like. I think this edition, this physical edition I have here, does actually come with a couple of map versions, but the primary thing you get is this sort of canvas map. For the video version, you can see here I've got myself an embroidery ring. I've got some buttons and beads and a biscuit tin to put them all in, obviously. And so I've been practicing some of my threading skills with that. So not much. I've only played a couple of rounds, not much to comment on it yet, but just another skill that I'm learning, another TTRPG artifact. So yeah, having fun with that so far.
Yeah, there you are, getting your hands in motion. That's great. Very cool. Well, that's a couple of cool topics to cover in our very first appetizer.
Absolutely.
What do you think? Is it time to roll into it?
Feeling hungry? Okay.
Let's
go to the main course.
Yeah. So you want to start off with yours?
Sure. It's at the top of the notes here. So let's just start with that. So if you indulge me a little bit here for our very first main course, that is. You and I actually met up yesterday for what is now a tradition, 2 years in a row. It being my birthday week, we got some friends together and played a six-player game of Eclipse Second Dawn for the Galaxy. So we've discussed this a little bit before, I think last year when we played it. So this is, I just want to go into a little more detail now that I've played it a couple of times now. So this is the second edition of Eclipse, came out in 2020, designed by Tuku Tahkokallio and published by Lauta Pellet, a Finnish publisher, which is I'm quite a fan of. So did you have an experience with the previous edition, Mark, or was this your sort of first time in?
No, I had a pretty extensive experience with Eclipse First Edition. It was one of the games that my first game group kind of really got into.
Yeah,
same. One of the first ones. And I also owned the iPad app. They have pretty okay iPad app for the first edition. Unfortunately, they haven't kept it up to date with the latest changes or the new factions, even from the first edition. But I probably played OG Eclipse like, I don't know, a dozen times. So a decent amount.
I played quite a few times with my friends back in Australia, and yeah, but it's been a delight to revisit it. It's always been sort of my favorite balance of exploration, sort of war game, Ameritrash, dice rolling mechanics, and some light sort of Euro engine building mechanics.
Yeah, it was really one of the first few games to really thread that needle between Eurogame and Ameritrash sensibilities. In fact, those terms kind of have fallen to the wayside since about that era when the first Eclipse came out, because so many games became, a little bit more cognizant of that divide. Or were able to bridge that divide more successfully. And this was one of the first out of the pack. And the gameplay holds up. Like, there's so much, like, kind of chance and theme to it, but there's a lot of structure and elegance to it as well. It's way more dry than, say, a Cosmic Encounter. But it has so much more flair and lack of restraint than something like a Hansa Teutonica, you know.
Well, let's roll back and just describe that in a little more detail to set the stage here. So it is a sci-fi, not quite a 4X game, but a war game, I guess. Each player has their own faction. It's go 2 to 6 players. It's quite versatile. In your little corner of the galaxy, you start on sort of the outer edges of the galaxy. And as you can explore, you can expand out from there, but largely everyone's really funneled in. The sort of the center of the galaxy is established at the start of the game, with this giant, big sort of Death Star miniature egg in the middle of the table. And as you explore, everyone's sort of start connecting up with that. You're exploring, you're putting cubes out to generate your income with that will let you get more money for actions. It will let you get more materials to build ships, and it will let you get more research to research new technology. That technology has a wide variety of effects over the course of the game, but primarily can be used to then upgrade your ships, because each of your ships, I think each player has like 3 or 4 different schematics of different ship models that can then be modular, that you can sort of plug in new little upgrades as you unlock new tech there. Is there anything else I should cover there, Mark?
This game, I was reminded while you were giving that succinct description, was, I think, one of the direct influences for another game that's already itself fairly old, if you look at it now, called Scythe. If you recall, Scythe also has, the ability to be quite an aggressive kind of direct confrontational game if the players want it to be. But you can also turtle effectively and sort of shelter yourself and play a kind of defensive isolationist game. And Eclipse certainly lets you do both. And I think the concept of the pulling the cubes and or discs off of the board and transferring them somewhere else really got its direct inspiration from this game, or this game helped popularize that. It kind of like it gave a upgrade to board game kind of UI ever since.
Such a huge impact. I'm not sure when it came out, but Terra Mystica is the first one that comes to mind for me that really blew up that the graphic design of having cubes or buildings on a track, and you move them off that track, revealing your income, which is just such an intuitive, clever mechanic. So many games are using it now, but here they've really zeroed in on that in this second edition here, where you've got the 3 different resources, and as you put those cubes on those tracks out onto planets, and that's where we'll reveal your new income. But also you've got your influence tokens, the forbidden lozenges, various colors and flavors that you'll be putting out, which both is your influence over tiles on the board, like you're owning those sectors, but also using those same tokens for actions.
Yeah, that's right. So you can essentially, by placing them to indicate your influence within sectors of space, it instantly increases the amount of cost that you have to spend to cover your upkeep every round. So the elegance is really right there. It's just so intuitive. And then the cubes that you place on each planet within a sector also increases the amount of resources that you produce from three various tracks. So it's just so natural feeling.
Yeah.
And other than the slight annoyance of having to fill each one of those slots at the beginning of the game, it after that is just such a breeze to play.
All things considered, though, this game is a delightfully breezy to set up, though, right? For such a big, like, huge game, like, everything is contained within those player capsule trays. And right. it's set up, everyone's setting up their own faction within 2 minutes, basically.
That's why this UI is so effective, because it shows that level of restraint.
Yeah.
There's only, like, two types of resource markers for multiple types of resource, and you take them off and you slot them over there, and then it basically eliminates any sort of accounting that you have to do.
Yeah, it's a very organic way of limiting your sprawl. It's like in Civilization, when you start having too many cities, you have increased costs. But this is a very organic way of doing that. You have a variable action counts. Like, you can take as many actions as you want, as long as you can afford them. So it's quite dynamic, but incredibly intuitive there. And then you said restraint there, which is another word that generally came to mind with me in all elements of this game. I think it's just enough of everything. It's just enough engine building. There's just enough luck in the dice rolling. I think it avoids going all in, like so many sort of big flashy Kickstarter games these days, not to mention names. I've played a couple of other 4X games this year, and every time I've just thought I'd rather be playing Eclipse. This is just too much.
Yeah, and our game actually went fairly long, and maybe yeah. It's because of we were playing it at a leisurely pace. There might have been some AP analysis paralysis to be
taking
had
break
there.
For pie.
With, yeah, six people as well.
Yeah,
it took us about close to 6 hours. Would you say?
Yeah, about that. And I think that was set up and explaining for a couple of new players, taking a break. I think you probably could have gotten through it in 4 hours. And with experience, like in 3 hours. And I will say that six, it was fun. It's epic. I would, I think, prefer to play it at four. I'm curious how that would play. Because it felt like it was really hard to see. The central board, let alone see players on the other side of the board and what they're capable of on their ships.
Yeah, I feel like for six players, about once a year is the right span of time.
Yeah, for special occasions.
Yeah, that's right. It's a perfect dish to pull out for those special occasions. It tasted all the more delicious because we had the full number of six. Everyone was into it. And we played with a bunch of different play styles. It was a fairly well spread balance between sort of initial engine building and turtling and exploration. Fairly typical. A lot of research to be had. And then, as you might expect, about halfway through the game, the fisticuffs started coming out. And then I think it was you made the first grab for the center space, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I played slow and steady. I think we were all playing fairly cautiously as relatively new players. And gradually sort of, we all tended to explore outwards, see what resources we can find first. And you have to sort of dictate what your engine is capable of and improvise with that. But I'm very lucky with some technology. I raided off some pirates, used that to sort of leverage into the middle and grab that center, defeated the Death Star, basically was able to hold that center space, which is worth a lot of points and sort of income generation, but it obviously also then makes you the target. So you've got to be careful not to grab that too early before you're ready to sort of fight to keep it.
Right. The one of the complaints that I certainly level at this game, and we've been pretty overflowing with praise so far, but this game has a tendency to be very swingy in the amount of resources that you might expect to access early on in the game. I think this is a reason why most versions of Scythe have a fixed board. You might think all of them do, but there is actually a dynamic version of Scythe that does allow you to generate the map spaces. But in this case, the map of the galaxy is always created dynamically. Basically, when a player chooses to explore, they look at one or two, in the case of, well, who is it? The Planta? I don't know. One of the races.
I think that's right. Yeah.
They can look at two planets. And you're either allowed to place the disc, the tile, or not place it.
Or get nothing. Yeah.
Waste your time. Nothing that round. Exactly. So I think you and Joe and Pat on one side of the board got a decent amount of resources and tiles. Ironically, some of the, what was it, the warp? The full,
yeah,
full
blown all the warps are sort of points. Cornered into one segment of the map.
Just kind of funny. Yeah. And then I think you and probably Ted and I got like medium amount of resources. And then I had some initial resistance with the space precursors. And then one player, Other Mark, he got saddled with very few resources. Mm,
basically empty sectors, essentially.
Yeah, so in an eight-round game, if you spend the first three rounds of the game, or four, without many resources to speak of, basically your growth is going to be inherently slowed.
Yeah.
And the players that do manage to have a initial boon of resources, then they are going to have their advantages kind of snowball.
There is definitely luck in the draw, and some people will get incredibly lucky or unlucky with those draws. I do like how those tiles sort of not force your engine, but sort of guide your engine in a particular direction, and you have to improvise with that. I think with experience, you would find ways around those sort of roadblocks, like spreading out and going into it, not necessarily attacking other people, but sort of beating other people to other areas of the map, perhaps. And if you know, or be able to utilize your factions. And I think each of us perhaps wasn't putting our factions to the full effect. I think, like, there was, for example, the one that could cohabitate with the ancients and basically get points at the end of the game for any of those sort of, those ancients being the neutral sort of NPC ships. And if there are any left at the end of the game, they get points. But by the end of the game, there's only one left on the ship. Or on the map, I mean. So perhaps he should have been going out and actually proactively protecting them, going out, finding them, protecting them, and camping out there. Instead of playing a role, I think this game can really encourage. Like, there was the other Mark was playing the basically a roaming band of mercenaries, but didn't really attack anyone until the last round or two. But if you're playing that role earlier on and actually getting out there into the weeds of it, perhaps it'd be a little more luck.
Yeah, I think you're right to a point, but if you don't have the initial boon of those resources to start with, you really can't afford to explore. You can't afford to have so many ships, or your faction bonus doesn't give you the ability to research or explore so steadily. So I think basically, in all cases, early advantages snowball, and you're right. If you let opportunity go by, then if you get that timing wrong, then you're going to have a very uphill climb.
And there is some diplomacy to account for as well. You can make friends with other players. Maybe if you're not having too much luck, go out and meet other people. That lets you put cubes out, which gets you a little more income. And if you're not playing particularly well or not having much luck, there's not much incentive for others to attack you for the sake of it. Unless you actually have something of value, people aren't just going to come and destroy you for the sake of it. At least not in our games.
Well, yeah. I mean, near the end of the game, Other Mark started to basically had a choice between two players and chose to attack me just for
some light kingmaking there.
Yeah, exactly. So anyways, I'm not bitter or anything. I didn't win this time around. I did win on the inaugural year. 46 points. And who won this time around, Daniel?
I am proud to say I managed to claim that trophy for myself this year.
That's right. We're going to have to make a physical trophy now. It's an annual tradition.
Yes, yeah. Get a big Death Star, like a Lego Death Star or something.
Yeah. How about we talk a little bit about the new factions?
Yeah. So I managed to find that one of my local game stores had the new expansions. They each add two new factions. So we had four each. There were four new factions total. So that brings the total to 10 factions. And so I think we were playing with three of the new ones. So three old, three new.
Yeah, I was playing with the kind of the orbital people, the people that like orbitals and made them sort of more defensive than standard. And what were the other ones? One of them was like the mercenaries that Other Mark was playing.
Yes, it was like the space Mongolians, I think, was the analogy there. I was playing the Wardens of Magellan, I think they were called, which basically just really like those discovery tiles. Like when you defeat the ancients, or sometimes when you discover a tile, you'll get these little random bonus chits that might give you some resources, might give you a tech for your ships. Or a few other sort of miscellaneous bonuses there. And so I wanted to hoover up as many of those as possible. And I got lucky with a few juicy ones there.
For sure. I actually really kind of like the original factions as well. I always thought they had a great balance. Other than the planta, the green ones, they're a little broken with how quickly they can expand.
Yeah, yeah.
Each of them has their own wrinkles, though. So I think 10 factions is just such a wealth of options to choose from.
The thing with you were talking about expanding there, the other thing we haven't mentioned is that when you explore, you basically dictating the directions that sectors can be entered from, because there's little wormhole halves on each hex, and you only when they're connected can you travel through there. So you can either you can create your own pathways, essentially, to either create pathways to other sectors or block yourself off so that other people can't get into your sector. There are some sort of roundabout ways with some technology, with some of those warp tiles that didn't really come up in this particular game. But that is a quite dynamic way you can sort of dictate the flow if you really want to turtle up or be aggressive and spread out.
That's right. There's these points at the end of the hexagonal tiles that are similar to, I don't know, like Settlers of Catan roads, where if you connect two points, then they're connected like a wormhole, like a tunnel. And typically, if you put a blank side of the hex against a wormhole side, they're not connected either. So I happen to isolate my sector of space off fairly well.
Completely, actually.
Yeah. Well, not by choice. I had one final area where I could have escaped, but Other Mark got to it first, and he blocked me off completely, but he happened to own the technology that let him pass through the half wormholes, whereas everyone else has to travel through the full wormholes. So I was trapped in my territory, but he was welcome to come into my territory.
He just trapped you in a box and then threw rocks at you. So, yeah.
So these are the ways you can utilize strategy effectively to box people off, to control, essentially establish your dominance across the battlefield. So I think it just does the theme to a T as well.
Yeah.
Everything totally makes sense. The technology is easy to read, easy to understand. The shipbuilding is super fun.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get customization. Yeah, I mean, like, because playing Stellaris and other similar games, you're customizing ships and units, I have zero patience for. I hate, like, hit auto-optimize every time. Just figure it out for me. Whereas here, it's reduced down to a very simple, intuitive system. Like, you've got each ship has, like, 4 to 8 squares, essentially. And each of those squares will be a module. It might be energy to power up other modules. It might be movement. It might be health points for your ship. It might be dice to attack, or it might be basically ways of modifying those dice, either positive or negative. Those dice, though, also have some range in, like, you might be rolling a whole bunch of ones that each do one damage, or you might roll one big dice that does 4 damage if it hits. And so within that, you have a pretty wide variety of options. You have to have the technology to buy most of those first. But it really does have a fun sort of ramp up as you gradually unlock new options and then tool out your ships. You can really specialize by the end of the game. Because you've got 3 different sizes of ships, and you can specialize. Well, the little ones are just will hit hard but have no health. Or you could just load them up with a bunch of health just to harass everyone and get in the way. I think I had I focused really hard on the mid-level ship, and just with all my rare tech that I happened to get off the Ancients, I was able to stack those up really powerful and just have one of those come in and sort of destroy a bunch of like Ancients by itself. Yeah, it's interesting. It does create a sort of rock, paper, scissor dynamic where if someone's building up a bunch of computers to improve their dice, another player might have a bunch of shields to protect against that, and someone else then might get missiles to sort of beat them to the punch. And so you end up in these sort of natural sort of rivalries and sort of who can beat who, and sort of that can play into the diplomacy as well. And so, well, if this player's getting ahead, who's in the best position to try and take on their ships? I do really like that sort of arms race and sort of push and pull. And sometimes you don't even know, like, oh, those two ships, I have no idea how those would fare against each other. Let's go fight each other just to see who would win. And everyone's always invested, I think. Because you just roll a bunch of dice and everyone was invested in all of the battles that took place.
That's right. It somehow manages to give players the maximal amount of choice.
Yeah.
But uses chance to mitigate dry certainty and determinism. So it is just such a elegant balance of all those things. Like, it kind of activates so many parts of my brain that this is a game that I could, you know, play forever. Maybe we will be playing this in 20 years in your 22nd annual birthday's Eclipse tournament. I think it's until maybe the new version, a new edition of Eclipse will come out by then.
Yeah, well, hopefully they'll do another version of the app. I'd love to explore that some more.
Yeah, that's it's a fantastic game, so it deserves to be played more for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very expensive game, I will say. I got it secondhand off of a friend. I was lucky in that regard, but well worth it. I found it's hell of a time, and it scales really well. So I've played it with two, and it surprisingly it's a tense duel. I am very curious to play it at four. I think that's really going to be the sweet spot, and just have some back and forth, but with enough room to actually see what everyone's capable of.
Well, there you go. That's going to hold us off until your next birthday tournament.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. One more year around the sun. Cool. Okay. Well, that was Eclipse Second Dawn of the Galaxy.
Right. All right. Let's talk about our second main course option since we're doing
what are you bringing today?
Now. The game I brought is a game that you've also played a little bit of.
Yeah.
And it's a game that I've not finished, but using the spirit of this new format, this is a great opportunity to talk about my impressions so far. And that game in question is a video game called Dragon Quest 3 2D HD Remake or something.
Love these. Of this sort.
That's right. Lots of D's, and you don't know whether it's a 3 or a 2. But it's the new one, which is using the kind of 2D HD art style, which is all the rage now with Japanese RPG studios, particularly Square Enix. They're making bank off of that pattern, off of that trend. So, of course, this is a remake of the famous Dragon Quest series, which is up to 11 now, I believe, on all the major new consoles. And Dragon Quest was also called Dragon Warrior in America and Canada way back in the day. I played the first one on the NES, and I just made sure for my kid that my oldest, that Dragon Warrior 1 was installed on their handheld device as well, so they can have a little taste of that history.
The first one's quite short, right?
It's very straightforward, and it's surprisingly short. I actually played it most recently on Android. I think there's an Android app version.
Cool.
It's pretty straightforward. It's got, you know, okay enough pixel graphics. But anyways, let's talk about Dragon Quest 3. So I took this out of the library, and I had it for only 1 week, but I really was enjoying this, so I played it pretty intensively. First of all, this game looks fantastic. Say what you will about the 2D HD art style, but there's some real artistry in work in the new pixel sprites for these characters. These pixel art characters look like Akira Toriyama art, but with the pixel art treatment, they, I guess, look a lot like maybe Final Fantasy Tactics level characters, just a lot of depth and shadow. The lighting in these games, the lighting engines are really where the HD shines. The characters carry these torches, and then when they walk around pillars in a dark dungeon or tunnel, then you see that the light is casting these really moody, effective shadows all over the place, adding to the atmosphere of the gloomy music and the kind of like echoey water drops dripping in the dungeon. So it creates this wonderful mood. And you played the game. What did you think about the art?
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about Octopath Traveler 2 recently. And I struggled with that art style there a little bit. And just that it felt completely oversaturated. A lot of glare, a lot of light flare. A lot of the models were very nondescript. Like, it was just really hard to tell what they were. There wasn't much detail there. It was just very busy. Whereas here, I think the art and the models especially just really pop. And it is a really nice contrast with all of the models. They're nicely detailed, just nice balance with the pixel art, but also being distinct enough that to differentiate them all. And yeah, and those levels all have a lovely depth to it. It's not just a flat dungeon. There's stairs and elevation and sort of paths that loop around each other in some really clever ways. And yeah, I think this is a really nice balance with the 2D HD. I've been a little bit lukewarm on that art style, but I think this is sort of the peak of that so far.
Yeah, I agree. I also don't know how I feel about 2D HD, but if anything, this game did it best. Mm. And I think a lot of that has to do with just the kind of artistic consistency of the Dragon Quest world, the Akira Toriyama designed characters and monsters as well.
And those monsters are all very distinct, but also very simple and just very clean, simple character design that really pops. Yeah.
Yeah. And those character designs obviously were pencil drawings first from the great comic manga creator. He did them all as line illustrations with full color. And a lot of those creature designs would show up on t-shirts, lunchboxes, pen cases, and snack boxes and things like that in Japan for generations. So there's, you know, literally full-grown adults who grew up with Dragon Quest always being around. That pedigree is there. That tradition is there.
I was playing this with a little with my daughter, and she was instantly hooked on the slimes. Oh, don't kill the slimes! Don't kill the slimes! I had to assure her there are friendly slimes. We will make friends with the slimes. She loves the character design.
Yeah, I don't know if that Pokemon-style monster capturing and arena combat that you can pit them.
The monster slavery is a little odd, forcing them to fight, but they like it apparently.
Yeah, that's right. It lets them blow off steam.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if that mode was in the original Dragon Quest III at all, but it's a cute addition.
Yeah.
Little superfluous.
That's what makes it hard to talk about this in general. I'm not particularly familiar with the original, so I'm not sure here what is new or what was always there, because I've been reading up on it. There's a lot of quality of life features in this game. But reading up on the original, a lot of that was already there. And I think the auto heal button, like you go into the menu and use one button to auto heal your party between fights. And that feels like a very modern sort of quality of life feature, but this was there in 1988. This game came out the month that I was born. So there's a way to date you.
It's another birthday callback.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
To Daniel's day of birth. This old first generation of RPGs was really quite obtuse. There were a lot of cases like Fantasy Star I was telling you about. You have to go into a menu to search the ground that's in front of you rather than just pressing a button. And this game adds a lot of those quality of life improvements, like you said. So unlike the early editions, you can speed up combat. So you can have ultra fast battles. That alone gave me enough of a impetus to play this game on the HD remake as opposed to on an emulator where I can through the power of software fast forward the screen generation anyway. But I felt like I didn't really need it. This game also provides convenient autosave feature where you can save anytime. One quick save, which once it's loaded, disappears, is deleted. So that's their compromise, because Dragon Quest traditionally can only save at fixed save points. And that is very much the case with this one here.
You spoke a little there about some of the sort of obtuseness of some of these games. And I think that is definitely still here. They've, at least in some of the mechanics, not really explaining themselves. And I think that's part of the charm in the game. Is like, you have to go walk around and talk to every single character to find out what these things do. Like, there's all these personality types that you can unlock for your characters. Like, oh, they're a cheerleader. Oh, they're a lone wolf. And there's no real indication of what that means. There's a lot of mechanics that the game doesn't explain that maybe would have been in the manual originally. But the game wants you to go around and explore all of the side areas, talk to all the NPCs to, like, mechanics are secrets in a way here.
Yeah, I really miss that aspect of retro RPGs now that I've been playing so many, that you actually had to talk to NPCs and they had a reason for being there.
Yeah.
I feel like modern day RPGs, unless the character has a big ass exclamation mark sprouting out of the top of their head, players feel like they're free to ignore anything around as just background scenery. But in those old games, you had to talk to every person in town, and you sometimes had to take notes on the things they said, because that would be your map markers. That would be your quest indicators. That would tell you what a certain item does, or even just hint at where you might need to go next.
Or where they saw a monster, for example, the Monster Colosseum. Oh, I saw a weird knight hanging out by this tree at nighttime. So you might not otherwise stumble upon those.
Yeah, so I feel like that's an element that's sorely missing from modern day RPGs that have streamlined that all to heck. That people just look in their quest journal or whatever.
Well, it's so hard not to just Google it, though. Like, I have to constantly force myself to look it up. Like, what is Lone Wolf? Is Lone Wolf good, or should I be a cheerleader instead?
Yeah, this game actually has some options. So you can go into the menu and choose whether some of those quest markers are turned on or off.
Right.
I, being a slightly old curmudgeon, turned a lot of those options off. So the next place I need to go, I turned off. The map markers, except for towns that I had previously visited, were turned off. So thankfully, however you like it, old school or new school, you can choose how you like it here. I think you can turn off things like auto run and things like that as well.
Right.
But yeah, this game was innovative in a lot of different ways in its own right. The first game, I think, was the first one that let you choose the makeup of your party.
Yeah.
Which classes to use, which is like a lot of modern games barely let you do that.
Well, the thing is, though, that all of those characters you choose have zero character, though. There's no dialogue. That you can name them, but they're just puppets. They don't actually say anything. Right. There's no story there. It's just your main character is the only sort of named character, so to say.
Yeah, they're a bag of statistics is what they are.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I totally agree with that. That is one gripe I do have about this game so far, other than the fact that it is utterly charming. But you're right, your party of characters, they are not characters. They're just there. They're mechanical devices for you to slay beasts with. And that they play in an interesting way. But yeah, if you do expect this to be some sort of deep introspection into the character behind your party, no, you're going to have to look at the Final Fantasy series for that. Because even by the early Final Fantasies, they had named characters that had fixed plots and fixed classes.
At the same time, though, you can customize your party completely from the get-go. It's not like some Final Fantasy games where it's like 20 hours in before you finally get a healer or something, you know, right? Like, oh, I'm stuck with these three characters and I've got to just roll with their skills until I find another one.
You're right. And you're not even choosing from the eight named characters. You're choosing from any combination of juggler, boxer, fencer, magician, cleric, healer.
The beastmaster or something. Yeah, there's quite a few
there. So many character classes. I'm sort of kind of sticking with my team and seeing how it goes, unless some sort of boss tells me that I can't possibly beat them. I'll just stick with the party that I have. They seem to be doing okay. Other aspects about this game I want to talk about is the music. The music is done in an extremely lush, fully orchestral arrangement. There are multiple versions of themes, in fact, overworld themes, town themes. It changes based on whether you're in a town at daytime or nighttime. They have all sorts of arrangements of this absolutely epic,
they're all bops,
classic sounding music. The music for the Dragon Quest series has always been stirring, but this rendition, I don't know what symphony does the recording, but it's so well recorded, played, and implemented on the game side that it's just an audio treat. And if you were worried that some of those lovely 8-bit sound effects that we all love so dearly would be gone, no, they're right in there. Every time we walk between rooms or between floors of a dungeon, you get that really crunchy footstep sound that everyone loves to hear. So it has a deep respect for the tradition that it's trying to uphold with this new slick version.
You do have to have some nostalgia for this, though, because like in terms of the story and gameplay, it is pretty light. Like the story is basically a series of fetch quests. I haven't gotten to the main thing yet. I think you end up collecting 5 MacGuffins of some kind. I'm still working on the early fetch quests. So I go to here, go to here, go to here. So sending you on this string of back and forth. Strangely enough, though, it's the map is very obviously modeled off on the real world. Other than that weird island that you start on, that's like I guess Atlantis or something, I guess. But like you go to Romeria, and like you have to collect his magic pasta fork or something. Like it's all very like each city you go to is very much modeled on a real world city. It's a little bit tropey.
And you go to Ibis, which has got the Egyptian, the classical Egyptian,
or the Middle Eastern cultures. City is all about belly dancing, and like that's all they do is they have belly dances. It's a little on the nose.
Yeah, that I think that it's kind of matches the Japanese worldview, particularly in the 80s when this game was originally created. Yeah. It was probably done with nice intentions to begin with. But the localization actually handles it really in a delightful manner. Just like chuckle to myself, like this game has so much charm. While the characters are not characters, the world is very much alive.
There's a flavor there, yeah.
The flavor is there. Of course, you got your big burly guys with the horn helmets.
The Robin Hoods.
That always talk with the Cockney accent, which is quite hilarious. And then they go to Romeria and everyone's talking with like pigeon Italian, Italiano coming out here and there. And then they go to this area and that, and then the accents come pouring out, the dialects are all there, even in just text form. Surprisingly, a little bit disconcertingly, this game has a lot of voiceover.
Yeah, it's always inconsistent, though. I've noticed that a lot these days in JRPGs, it's very inconsistent as to when something is voiced or not. It's just bouncing back and forth is very off-putting sometimes, not knowing when. Yeah, you can just listen.
I kind of agree. I kind of wish like all the voice over work was not there. Maybe they thought it would be suicide to launch a RPG, a JRPG in 2024 or whatever without voice over there. So there is some, it is well done, but I don't love it. And I wish it would just stuck to the text, but the text itself, the localization of it is done very well. They hired a great team, and it just kind of sings with personality. So another quality aspect to this really well-produced game, I think. I'm very sold on it, as you might be able to tell. What is your feeling about this particular one?
Yeah, I mean, enjoying it. It's pretty simple mechanically, but it's also I've been churning through it pretty quickly. Like it's relatively easy early on, at least. I did hit a big difficulty spike. I'm like right around the pyramid dungeon, basically, and suddenly there's enemies that one shot you because the combat here is quite interesting. But I'll talk about that in a little bit, but. I'm not really sure whether I should be out grinding because there's no side quests really to do in this game. It's just that main sort of fetch quest you're on. And maybe I should just be running around outside town grinding for half an hour because it's so quick with the fast battles. Everything's on auto battle largely. You can probably grind out some experience pretty quickly here. So maybe that's the key to it.
I think grinding is pretty much recommended.
It's assumed, I guess, to an extent.
In early JRPGs, for sure, grinding was the standard MO.
Yeah.
You pretty much had a guarantee that it would be there. This game actually does give you a decent reason to do some exploration. There are a lot of secrets hidden out there on the world map. There are these like shiny points on the world map that are like quite simple bonuses. They're kind of like treasure chests, you can imagine. They have like 5 random items in them or something like that.
Yeah, I've been really thorough with exploring the map, but still haven't like ground enough, obviously.
Yeah, but some parts of the map are actually distinct encounters, I guess you could call it that. So like a little one standing lone tree might be like a little forest glade.
Secret zones,
You have a scene or with a character, or you might find one of those friendly versions of the monsters you were hunting down before. So I really appreciated that as well. Yeah, you and I must have ended around a similar point because I just got to...
We both had it for a week.
area.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought that the combat was pretty easy and pretty boring, to be honest.
It's almost an auto battler, to be honest.
Yeah, because this game, I don't know if the original game had it, but you can sort of program your characters to fight for you, literally automatically.
And it's the default, which is unusual. Usually it's an option, but it's really the default to have them on auto attack.
Yeah, I think the default, if I'm not mistaken, was that your main character is controlled manually, and that the other three characters are fight automatically. There are six different presets for the automatic fighting style. One of them was like fight wisely, I think is the default.
Focus on healing.
Yeah, focus on healing is one. Go all out, so one that does not respect MP conservation at all is another one. So I appreciate how that's there. And only once or twice did I have to disable the automatic
fighting. Like bosses, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes it would be actually be good because I could say conserve MP for all of the grinding until I get to the boss. And then when I get to the boss, I can turn off all the automatic and I could finally tune what actions get used and I'll have still conserved all my MP up until that point.
But curiously, even when you have control of your characters, you still don't have full agency because there might be, say, three Robin Hoods and two vampire cats. You can choose to attack one of those groups, but you can't determine which of those individual monsters to fight. You attack the group, and then it seems to randomly choose one of those two to three monsters to attack within that group. So in that sense, it's still somewhat on autopilot. It's an auto battle mode.
Yeah, I like how the game handles certain weapons. So certain weapons can attack a group, so like three blue slimes, or even some claws? Weapons... Yeah, some weapons can attack even the whole row.
Oh, the whips can. Yeah,
whips are some, and then another is boomerang.
The boomerang,
is another. So combining those, and then having some of the tougher tanks have the sword for the individual powerful attacks, actually gives you a lot of versatility in how you tackle monsters. And it's interesting. You might have. It's based off of like their lineup in the ranking. So you might have two blue slimes and then a Draki and then one blue slime.
Yeah,
The three blue slimes are not considered to be in the same group.
Especially if they call in reinforcements after the fact and they all end up on opposite sides of the battlefield. Yeah.
So there's a unique logic to it, but I find it kind of charming. So.
And again, there's some nuance to that that you have to discover over the course of the game. Like you might find a boomerang, but not actually realize what it does mechanically until you test it out or find someone that tells you, some NPC in the corner of the world somewhere.
Yeah, but I will still give kudos to this version because it lets you do both. If you want one way, you can do one way. You can do it the exact opposite way or something in between. You have fine tooth control over when to apply that.
This reminds me a lot of the sort of first edition D&D vibes. I think it's like Tomb of Horrors, which is this old school Dungeons and Dragons. It's basically throwing you into a dungeon as a pretense to fight monsters and collect treasure. The story is really there as an afterthought. It's just here, go on an adventure, fight some wacky monsters, do some puzzles. The rest is a pretense.
That's right. That's what OSR tries to recapture in this modern day and age with tabletop RPGs. Mm-hmm. And then eventually JRPGs just evolved into like little, you know, animes, right? Like
epics.
They are just their own little cartoon series that continues with their own fan service or whatnot. And then now you have isekais, which are stories that work with JRPG tropes.
More on that later.
You might say there will be. Yeah, I don't want to talk too much more about Dragon Quest 3 HD after this because I have only played the 1 week, but I'm enjoying it so far.
Yeah.
I think of the 2D HD RPGs I played, this is the one I'm enjoying the most. And I find it's very refreshing to play a game that is so direct and kind of like tightly designed and has a very close focus as opposed to big sprawling games that
there's no frills here. It's just
too much.
Very focused. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I'm enjoying myself.
Excellent. Yeah. I'm looking forward to getting back to this as well. And it's just very charming and delightful sort of setting that my kid loves as well. And I'm reminded that the very second episode of the podcast, we covered Dragon Quest Builders.
That's right. I need to go back to the Dragon Quest Builders. I feel like I didn't give it a proper shake.
Yeah.
And maybe I might play number one through because I actually have it on the PS Vita. So I could play through it there.
Yeah, I have a better appreciation for that world now than I did at the time, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe I need to play the games that directly inspire the builders because they are based on actual entries.
One and two, I think. It's like it's like the bad ending from one of the early games, I think.
Right. Got to play through them.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's a pretty good bite at those
two. Yeah. Well, if you've got room for a little bit extra there, we're just going to wrap up with a little dessert and talk about something else that we've been enjoying outside of games.
That's right. Our very first dessert course. Please start us off.
Yeah, so as hinted there, I've been watching some anime. So at PAX last year, I hooked up with some board gaming friends who have a little anime book club. So I've been watching some with there, enjoying some shows that I wouldn't otherwise have thought to get to. Like, prior to last year, I'd only seen two or three shows, basically. Delicious in Dungeon last year really got me on board with anime. I've been looking to explore some new ones. And so now with this new book club, I've been exploring a few. And so the latest one I'm hooked on is Shangri-La Frontier, which, similar to what you were talking about, is an isekai. In that it's set in a virtual reality MMO, basically. So most of the action takes place in there. There's some scenes outside of that. There's some scenes in the real world and in other games. But mostly it's in this one MMO. And obviously it's very tropey. I haven't seen many shows from this genre to understand, to appreciate how much of this is just repeating other similar shows. So I'm appreciating some of my ignorance here, but I do appreciate I'm enjoying how it gets into the sort of game design as part of the show. It's not just numbers and monsters and levels. There is some of that, but there's a lot of discussion of, well, this boss here is obviously trying to train characters to parry. It's acting as a block to teach players this particular behavior, or try to incentivize a particular behavior in how the zones are set up. And so I appreciate the sort of the psychology of game design that's going on behind the scenes here. And also, like, for a game, it is all in the game. Like, there are zero stakes in the sense that no one can die, but I think it still does manage to imbue a good sense of stakes in that everyone has their own motivations, whether it's like beings just really powerful, collecting a particular artifact, or player killing. There's a whole player killer faction, or people collecting animal pets. Everyone has their own motivations in this game, and that they take it seriously. And the stakes are there that are in some really clever ways where they sort of bounce sort of player social dynamics off of each other.
Yeah, isekai is a very sort of postmodern flavor of anime and manga that really takes a crack at, it's sort of like media criticism, right? It takes a look at a form of media and sort of breaks it down. And the earliest instances of isekai follow that mold. And the newer ones have become even more and more sort of intense about it.
Mm.
Another game that I'm reminded of is another manga series that I read, the first volume of, I'm reminded of, is called like Quality Insurance in a Fantasy World or something about that. So the premise is that you're a QI, you're a QA.
It's like a tester. Okay.
Worker, a video game tester who's transported into a game world, but all of the characters believe in the world that they're in and they think it's real. So, of course, the funky main character who's intentionally rubbing his face against the walls to make sure that he can't teleport them through them is ironic and funny from us, the reader, because we're in on the joke, right?
Yeah.
But the inside the world characters are not.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole episode of Shangri-La Frontier. It's basically upgrading a weapon. Like, he goes to a master artisan, and he's upgrading it to a higher quality. And the whole episode is just like this craftsman singing a poem and really leaning into it. And it's just it's given his reverence in taking the game world seriously that I really appreciate.
That reminds me of a podcast I listened to about, I think it was the West End Games D6 version of Star Wars RPG. So basically the Star Wars RPG was one of the first RPGs, period, and also it was one of the first pieces of Star Wars merch, period. In the long dry spell between movies, a lot of what the world building of Star Wars came from those settings and worlds that they described in the West End Game books. So the sort of the media inspires the other form of the media, and then the other form of the media is inspired right back from it.
Snake consumes stone tail. Yeah.
So it's all pointing back to this long tradition of media being inspired by other media. So I think this is another great form of that. You know, it's not fine art, Shangri-La Frontier. I read the first.
It's good fun though. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fine. It's a whole lot better than a lot of entries in the series. Like there's some terrible ones.
Yeah, the other one I was watching was Solo Leveling, which isn't exactly an isekai because it's like portals in the real world that you can't die in, but there are game mechanics. And so, but it was all about, oh, I've got a 10% attack buff for 2 minutes. Oh, but the boss has a 30% rage timer for 5 minutes, and they're just flashing stats at you nonstop, and I just had no interest in that.
Yeah, I feel like the manga authors are just trying to kind of geek out and pretend that they're game designers in a lot of these cases. So maybe that's why you got the sense that it's a kind of game designer talk. Some of these authors are actually kind of thoughtful about how they apply logic, non-traditional logic, to some of the game worlds that they're inventing in this fictional form.
Yeah, they're not entirely coherent or consistent. But yeah, I'm curious how many of these authors actually have some game design sort of know-how.
Yeah, because like even things like you talked about Delicious and Dungeon, it has some pretty off-the-wall game logic built into it. Like a lot of the logic, like how one of the main characters' siblings gets digested by a creature, is not exactly logical because it sort of takes weeks.
There's some fascinating world building in that, though. And I believe that that author was largely inspired by the Wizardry video games.
There you go. Many, if not all, of the original JRPGs were inspired by Wizardry. So maybe we might have to tackle it as a sort of historical
exercise. I wonder if it works on our SPC.
Yeah, actually, the not Wizardry. There were some Wizardries for the NES. So we could definitely track those
down. There was also a remaster a couple of years ago.
That's right. The game series continues. All right, let's continue on ourselves, and I'll talk about my little last bite of dessert. One piece of media that I watched recently that's not game-related is called Ghostbusters Answer the Call. So this is not the newest one with young, Wolf. What's his name?
Wolf Finhart? Those words somewhere in that combination, yeah.
not with the young kids. This one is
Finn Wolfhart. Sorry,
that's the women. The women Ghostbusters. Whereas my wife likes to call it Lady Ghostbusters.
That was the last one I saw. I haven't seen any of the newer ones.
Yeah, and this is a sort of like alternate universe entry because some of the actors from the original Ghostbusters 1 and 2, at least, are in this movie, but they don't play their original characters.
Right.
Whereas I think the newest ones are sort of a direct continuation. So it's like the universe is diverging. Anyways, I watched this movie a long time ago. It has some of my most famous performers in it. On top of the original Ghostbusters cast members, it has Melissa McCarthy, Kristen Wiig. It has other Saturday Night Live alums like Leslie Jones.
That's the one, yeah.
And what is the other one? She's so funny. Oh, the name is... My youngest kid is going to be severely upset with me for forgetting her name. But just hilarious performers. And on top of that, they have Thor. They have... what's his face?
Chris Hemsworth in full Himbo mode.
That's right. And this is one of his best performances, I feel like.
I did enjoy that, yeah.
Hemsworth as the total moron, kind of eye candy, basically receptionist, was such a brilliant twist on the gender swap. And I don't know how you feel about this film. Have you watched this film?
Yeah, I mean, I saw it close to when it first came out. I don't remember much of it. I remember enjoying it, but I don't really have a particular reverence for the series to begin with. It was a little bit before my time.
Yeah, I feel like my generation is the one that was most affected by the initial salvo of merch and the toys and the costumes. And I remember getting like the slime in a tub from Slimer. There was the real Ghostbusters cartoon show, which was loosely based off of
the NES game being pretty good.
Right. There have been a few video games, but I haven't played a lot of them, or they don't stand out in my memory. But I just wanted to say, it's not very deep, but I enjoyed watching Ghostbusters Answer the Call.
Yeah. Ladies can be Ghostbusters.
I like the new cast, and I thought it wasn't the best, but it's easily better than Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
And I think it's a worthy entry. And the saddest thing about it is that there won't be any other Ghostbusters with this lovely cast of hilarious actors. And I'm really saddened by that.
And it was at least pushing the franchise in a slightly different direction, whereas the new ones are just doubling down on the nostalgia value and bringing back the old actors.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. They were trying something new. And the most awkward parts about Answer the Call were there was a lot of exposition early on. Actually, the intro drags quite a bit, more than the original films, I feel like. And then there's like sequences in the middle where they were just explaining that, hey guys, this is a toy that you can buy in Target. So go out and buy this particular weapon.
It's a little bit nudge, wink, wink at times, yeah.
Yeah, and that part I wasn't super into. No. But it all culminates in this fun sort of action sequence. There's jokes all throughout. And it holds up. I enjoyed it. So for a medium quality, you know, probably medium high quality Ghostbusters, I think people who haven't had given a shot should try this.
There was also a video game in like the PS3 era that I think was just called Ghostbusters, but it was like an official sequel.
Yeah, that's right. I think I believe Dan Aykroyd wrote.
For the game. I remember that being solid.
Yeah, and I think most of the actors, the living actors, reprise their roles as well. So that would be actually a worthy remake to check out.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, there you go. That's all I had to say about my bit. Mm-hmm. And with that, here's our first new format episode in the can.
Yeah. So, yeah, let us know what you think, if you like the new formats, if you've got anything particular you've been enjoying or have any thoughts on the games we've discussed. If you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. And you can catch us on YouTube. We put these episodes up on YouTube there for you to watch our very bright basements in video form. And sometimes our cats make cameo appearances, so that's always worth checking out as well. Please continue to like, subscribe, leave comments. We do check them out. We're doing our best to get back to
you. It's a birthday present to me, please.
Yeah, it means a lot. It gives us the incentive to keep going.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, I think this new structure works pretty well with guests. So I think if you have a game you'd like to talk about, whether it's your own project or just a game you've been enjoying and want to join us, please get in touch.
That's right. Yeah, I'm excited, actually, for our third year or third season, I guess. We're almost at episode 100.
Yes, yeah. So closing in fast there. Yeah, excellent. So yeah, you can also find us on Blue Sky. I'm at Board Game Feast there, and that we have the official OmniGamers Club account there as well.
You can find me as OmniGamer Mark on Blue Sky as well. So Daniel, I guess we don't have to announce necessarily the next game we're going to be covering. We will be talking about Wildlands at some point. We haven't.
Yes, I should have said. Yeah, yeah. We just
need to get more players.
Scheduling has been tricky. I mean, I really want to try it at 4. It's just been hard to get people together for that.
Yeah. Yeah. So now there's all the more reason for you to tell us about the games that you're excited to hear about, because we're conceivably covering twice as many games now.
Yeah, and it gives us options to cover smaller games too that we can't sort of talk about for an hour. But hey, 15, 20 minutes, again, I can talk about Drew Poulter, or I can finally talk about Hounds of Tonica.
We'd love to see it. All right. Yeah. Let's start thinking about our next games.
All right. Well, in the meantime, have a balanced diet of games.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.